This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Joining me today is a Baltimore-based artist whose medium of choice is food. From her website, quote, Rosemary Liss creates nourishing experiences that provide a symbiosis between mouthfeel and carnal perception, end quote. We'll be talking about how her love affair with fermentations began, her Nuka performance piece slash residency at the Noma Ferments Lab, and her current role at Bar Clavel. Welcome to the show, Rosemary.
Thank you for having me.
So let's do just that. Can you talk about your introduction to ferments at Hex? And now I'm seeing that there's actually a Hex Ferment sticker here.
That's so perfect. Awesome to see that. I wasn't sure if they'd come on the show, ferment about it, but looks
now
like they
there's,
did.
Yeah, there's living proof.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be here. And so a while back, I was doing a lot of freelance in the film world and feeling stressed out about that feast or famine of the paycheck. And I wanted some stability. And this small shop was opening up in a market near my house, and they were doing kombucha, sauerkraut, and kimchi. And I had met the woman, Megan, before. I had actually got some of her kombucha for the opening of a show I did. I wanted to have like a kombucha cocktail. And so I went up and I was like, I'd love to work for you. Part-time turned into full-time almost immediately, and I kind of fell head over heels in love with everything that was happening in that small space, from learning about the health benefits of fermented foods to the microbiome to kind of educating all of our customers, and then all of the textures, visual components of actually making the sauerkraut and the kimchi and the kombucha. And I started photographing everything, and suddenly this thing that was happening just as a job turned into such an inspiration for my studio practice, and everything kind of blended together. And a coworker at one point was like, oh, I just watched this episode of David Chang's Mind of a Chef, and he went to Copenhagen and was on this boat called the Nordic Food Lab. Check it out. And I went home and watched it that night, and I immediately emailed them the next day being like, I gotta come. It was just like there was something inside me that was like, this is the place for me. And actually, Josh Evans responded quite promptly and said, hey, we'd love to have you, because I kind of proposed a project for them. But they were in the process of moving from the boat to a lab in the University of Copenhagen. And so it was kind of a hectic time for them. He was like, we'll keep in touch. And actually, he emailed me months later. And I was up in Vermont doing a residency, actually working on my Nuka performance piece, something that I had kind of been inspired to create from being at Hex. We had a Nuka pot, which we can talk about. And he said, we're opening up applications for our summer intern program. Please apply. I did. Suddenly I was like in line to get a visa and going to Copenhagen summer 2015. I was there for 3 months.
So yeah. You were saying your work at Hex really influenced or inspired your studio practice. And so what was your studio practice before, and did the Nuka performance piece kind of overwrite that or become
Yeah,
it?
I mean, there was still a lot of like textural and the palette was very similar to things I was doing that were more two-dimensional and painting. I'd started doing more like installation pieces that were very amoeba-like before I even was thinking about the microbiome, but often I was just like in the studio making a mess. I came from creating these very bordering on abstract, but still in the realm of realism paintings of these big old movie theaters in Baltimore, something that was my thesis as a senior in college. And when I moved home, I wanted to get away from that. And I started just like diving into a different world. And then I was really influenced by everything that was happening at Hex. And I was like taking all these photos, sometimes secretly, because actually after a point we were like, okay, no more photos. It's having a phone is like a bacteria hotbed to have it like near anything that you're making in the kitchen. So you really shouldn't have your iPhone out or smartphone out in the kitchen space, but sometimes I'd sneak a photo. Sorry, Megan. And I was making these quilts that were digital images that I had kind of manipulated from taking a photo of the sauerkraut. And we were doing all sorts of different krauts, some with seaweed and burdock root and gold beets, and it was so beautiful looking. Yeah, and I was so inspired by all of that, and then also just learning more about my health through working there and having struggled with my own issues with health and digestion and things like that. It was such a like mind-opening experience. Yeah.
So in your initial email to the lab, did you already propose the NUCA project, or was that something that came after?
No, the NUCA, actually, I don't think we had even started working on the NUCA pot when I emailed them. The NUCA pot came like later in the summer that year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so for our listeners, can you explain what NUCA is?
NUCAzuke. So it's a Japanese pickle. It's a rice bran substrate that you bury any kind of vegetable, although now I learned fish, too. Yeah. You can put fish in it. And it once the bran, the bed, the NUCA pot has been active, basically any vegetable or food object that goes in it gets pickled overnight, which is incredible because it's such a hotbed of bacteria and yeast. Yeah. So to start a NUCA bed, some people add sourdough bread, a little bit of beer sometimes, and salt, a lot of salt. And the salt kind of keeps the pathogens at bay. And then as you're adding more vegetables, the yeast from the skins of the vegetables create this really warm and delicious bed of bacteria, good bacteria. Yeah. But sometimes it can get really weird. Like we were trying all sorts of things at Hex, and we started burying black Spanish radish, and it got too funky. It was like you stuck your hand in the NUCA bed to, so you aerate it. It needs to be aerated every day. It needs oxygen. And you would stick your hand in this bed, and sometimes it would be warm, but when we started burying the Spanish radish, it would be like hot in there. Started freaking me out. So, and then it started like smelling weird. We had to like put it away for a while. So we stuck it in the fridge with some mustard. Actually, if your NUCA ever gets really weird, put it in the fridge, cover it with mustard powder and salt, and let it sit and kind of like recharge.
What does the mustard do?
I think, so mustard can, like, combat, like, over yeastiness, I think, if I recall correctly. And it definitely, like, rebalances it. So we, like, did that for a month, and then I think, because it was so weird.
So did you have to remove all the vegetables?
Yeah.
Okay.
Before that, we were doing vegetables every day, and then whoever was in the shop the next day would have that experience of, like, unburying, and that for me was, like, the dance of unburying the vegetable every day and aerating it. And the NUCA we had was in a ceramic crock, and so you take this heavy crock off the shelf and then have this like little choreography with it every day. We called it our pet.
So, no, it's very much a pet. It's a very
high maintenance
pet. I know, I
get all stressed out now.
Yeah. So I have a NUCA bed, and I also have sourdough starter at home.
Yeah,
and
that's a lot. It's like you have kids.
No, seriously.
You can't go on vacation anymore.
Yeah, I'll be out. Like eating dinner, like, oh no, I have not fed that in 2 days.
Yeah,
it is
I'm
over.
Like, I'm a really bad parent. I started a NUCA again recently because my boyfriend is interested in Japanese pickles, and we're doing some experiments for a project. And I got really stressed out because we'll be really busy with our jobs and everything, come home super late, and then I'll be like, I can't do it right now. And we'll go 2 days without aerating it. So, but sometimes it actually, like, I know you're not supposed to do that, but sometimes the pickles taste really good after leaving it in there for 2 days. So
what do you do with this overabundance of pickles? Because my issue is every day I unbury, like, and you just have pints and pints of all these really salty.
Well, I brought some of mine.
Great. So add it to the file.
But they're really warm because they came on the bus with me. Aww, so I don't know if you want to eat them. Well, one thing we were doing at Hex was we started dehydrating a lot of them. Hmm. And so I think at some point, I don't know if I'm like blowing Hex's cover, but at some point there might be powders involved. I don't know if they're going to do anything with those or if it's just an experiment. But I love the idea of like powdering everything. Mm-hmm. It's such a great way.
How would the home cook apply a powder?
Yeah, well, you'd have to have a dehydrator, mm-hmm. and then you would have to have a good blender. And then the nice thing about that is the shelf life is so much longer, and you can then sprinkle it on anything, salads, and put in dressings and on top of fish or other pickles. Weird.
Would it still be active?
I think maybe if you do it on a very low setting. Okay. You know, on like the Excalibur, the lowest setting is for alive things.
Mm-hmm. That'd be really interesting if you could have
test it for its microbial activity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then use that to accelerate kind other pickles.
Kind of like
pickles.
A powdered probiotic, yeah, but exactly. Have it be. Maybe there's your new venture.
Yeah. GoFundMe. Here we go. Anyway, so let's take it back. So we were talking about the NOMA Ferments Lab. So yeah. You proposed this kind of quote-unquote performance piece.
So I'm not sure if I... The NUCA performance piece was actually done in Vermont at the Vermont Studio Center, and that was an artist residency. And while I was there, I got the email from Josh being like, please, if you're still interested, you can apply for the internship. I think actually this was my original idea, was to do something with kombucha SCOBY as more of an artistic medium. And I ended up doing that there, but I also applied with a more comestible project. So that's why I talked about NUCA as being something I was going to do research on there.
Okay.
So the NUCA part was more research based and less of the artistic component. And then I also, alongside of that, did this like big kombucha installation. But actually, while I was there, I kind of got fed up with doing my NUCA research because I got bored. A lab is maybe not the right place for me. I'm a little too chaotic, and the confines of like doing the exact same thing every day to figure out how things were gonna change and taste. So I was burying the same vegetable every day to give myself a limit and structure, but that ultimately was kind of suffocating, and I was watching all these people like plate beautiful Nordic style dishes, and my colleague Bernat, who's from Barcelona, he was doing this really cool research project on tempeh. So there's a lot of really awesome things going on there at the same time, and I was like, this is boring. I love NUCA, but I'm gonna stop. So then I started working specifically with kombucha and actually trying to figure out ways to like make dishes with the kombucha mother, with the zooglial mat, that membrane. And that was really fun because then I got to work with the other chefs in the lab and be like, well, if I do this, if I poach this, if I make kombucha with an oyster in the tizon, is that going to be disgusting or is that going to be really delicious?
Yeah.
And that was really fun. And I started doing a little bit more of a project on our relationship to disgust and kind of creating these beautiful dishes with the kombucha mother as this centerpiece. Ultimately, I found that it's very hard to still chew, like actually get your teeth through the membrane. So even when it's cut up into small pieces. But it was great to make all this kombucha. And then I had all these mothers that I also dehydrated and created this kind of quilt that hung over the lab so the light would go through it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What's the texture of it?
The kombucha?
Yeah, mother, not dehydrated.
Not dehydrated. It's almost like gelatin, but then there's this last thin layer that you can't really bite through.
And what's it made out of? Like, what gives it the structure?
Yeast and bacteria. Wow. Yeah. Just growing, I guess, I don't know exactly scientifically how it grows into that mat. Jonas, one of the other guys at the lab, got like really hardcore nerdy into the science component of it, and he could probably tell you, but I stayed a little bit more on the visual end of it. But it was really nice because there weren't that many kombucha companies in Copenhagen at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it was great. I actually brought a SCOBY over from Baltimore. So all the kombucha I made there was from this mother from Hex, yeah, mm-hmm. which was really fun. And I got to work with some kids that were just learning more about kombucha and doing their own research there. And so I got to help them with tasting things because I'd been working for a company that was producing kombucha on a mass scale for a long time. Mass as in like the, now they're almost mid-Atlantic, but at the time it was all Maryland. But definitely producing a lot. And it was nice to work with people and kind of share my experience with them. And then a lot of the core ideology of the lab is like working with local ingredients and that terroir, but using processes from all over the world. And so that was something that we were really trying to focus on, is like, how can we use different Gisons to make kombucha? It's really hard still to make a good kombucha without like green tea or black tea, but it works.
So this might be overly simplistic, but what's the difference in the process of making like a vinegar with a mother versus making like a kombucha?
So I don't know as much about vinegar, but actually it's a great question. And I was just visiting a vinegar company called Keep Well in Pennsylvania, and they're really great. And they actually started making vinegar by accident when they were making tepache, and they forgot about it. And so I think there's more of like an alcohol process. Okay. I know that if you let kombucha go, it doesn't turn into alcohol, it will turn into vinegar.
Huh. Okay.
But I don't know enough about vinegar to tell you the differences. I know there is a mother with vinegar, but it's not the same kind of mother as one that is from, I guess it's just like a different combination of bacteria and a whole different process. But it was really beautiful to see these vinegar mothers, and they were in these giant vats, and the mothers were like bigger than my arm stretched apart. And they would actually pull these mothers off like a couple times a week, I think, or at least once a week. Yeah. And the one thing I did learn, the difference between kombucha and vinegar is like if the mother falls, it actually is kind of detrimental to the vinegar, versus with kombucha, if the mother falls, it'll just grow a new one and it's no big deal.
Falls as in?
Actually like sinks to the bottom of whatever vessel you're fermenting in. Huh. It kind of, something about whatever's happening in that mother kind of changes the substrate in a negative way.
That's so dramatic. It's so like you go into the lab and it falls like, no, it's done.
But it's such a beautiful process either way. And that was always something that I was so drawn to about fermentation, is that it's so alive. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me how much like myself as a human is just, I'm just like covered and filled with bacteria. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not good bacteria. I just survived a horrible stomach bug and I thought I was going to die. So, yeah.
So does that relate to your work or on that kombucha project where you're talking about your relationship to disgust or our relationship to disgust?
Yeah, I think, well, part of it is the unknown, and then part of it is looking at things that, or this perception of things being disgusting. So something that's like slimy. But that's also that relationship to disgust can be one person's oysters, someone else's like, that's disgust. I don't know how to explain that well, but it really depends on the person. I like a lot of weird things that most people, I love eating tripe. I love lengua taco, you know, that's tongue. Mm-hmm. And I'll eat eyeballs. I love the fish heads. You'll see me in the corner in a kitchen, like scarfing down the fish head. So I like those things a lot of people think are gross. Mm.
So is that what you try to do with the kombucha art?
I think repurposing something. Yeah, that the actual installation was less about the disgust part and more about showing this thing that's often discarded, because just like your sourdough starter, you know, you have to throw out a little bit every time. Right. And the kombucha mother is constantly regenerating. It's almost exhausting. Mm-hmm. And often people just compost it, give it away. But if you dehydrate it, it becomes this vellum. You can draw on it. It's really beautiful, and it's pretty structurally sound too. And so I dehydrated them, laminated them, put them in a vacuum sealer, and then created this quilt.
Wow.
And I think it will be around for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it's encased in plastic now too, so. But it's beautiful because then the light shines through it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. With the dishes I was working on, those were more like creating beautiful little plates of things that, like an oyster shell with this, what looked like a little oyster, but it was actually a kombucha mother with squid ink and things like that. And then, so you're kind of turning that on its head.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, so then you could eat that?
Yeah. Yeah, so that dish specifically, which had mixed reviews, which is okay. You know, I don't always aim to please. I don't know if that project was a success, but that's okay. I actually made that kombucha mother came from the kombucha I put an oyster in.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was quite salty and weird.
Mm-hmm.
But it grew a mother, and then I harvested it, cut the kombucha into the shape of an oyster, put it in an oyster shell on a bed of like straw. Yeah. And then made people eat it.
So this is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to come back after a really short break.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margo and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used. And then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
This is Meant to be Eaten. I'm here with food artist Rosemary Liss. We were just talking about making a kombucha out of oysters and how the kombucha mother can maybe be edible, which I think ties really nicely into the theme of my podcast, which is, you know, what's meant to be eaten, what is not, or how a thing is meant to be eaten. And so how, when you're working with food, whether it's experimenting with these fermentations or styling a food set, how does your approach to food change, and how's it thinking about it change?
So are you asking based on the process I'm using versus
so
when I'm styling maybe for a photograph versus something that I would create for a friend or a meal?
Kind of. So even for this example with the oyster kombucha, right, you were cutting this oyster shaped object or oyster shaped kombucha mother and plating it.
Right.
It was probably very visually stunning, but is that intended to be a delicious experience, or is that more so like an art?
Yeah, I think with that, I was hoping a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
But that was where, you know, people agreed and disagreed with my project. That kind of also lands that experience in the, it just depends from person to person what tastes good or not. Yeah, I think often I aim for also delicious, but it doesn't always happen, and I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of things with Jell-O actually for different more edible experiences. So I'll do like oat milk Jell-O dusted with beetroot powder or kombucha Jell-O often, which is an interesting relationship. Like you have the kombucha mother that's almost gelatinous, but if you take the kombucha and just make jello with it, you kind of get a similar experience without having that weird membrane that you can't chew through. So often since then, I've done more things actually using gelatin or agar, which is fun. And that, for the most part, is always tasty. The thing about the kombucha mother is it's also so acidic that if that's not something you're into, it can be hard to digest.
Huh.
Yeah. But I'm also okay with everyone not enjoying the things that I make. That's just going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I had Jen on the show a few months ago, and we were talking about the different ways you can consume food, whether it's like a food photograph or actually food in front of you. And so how do you think when you are styling a set or when you are plating a plate of food, how does the intended reception or consumption change depending on what you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely points where in order to make it look good, the taste starts to fall away just because of the time it takes to put something together, or you're spending so much time on the visual component that, and maybe the recipe you were using was, I made these oat flour waffles ones with like cocoa and like some adaptogen powders, and I was really excited about it. And I styled this beautiful photo and they taste like crap. They did not taste good, but that's okay. I got a really nice photo out of it, so I don't know. It's a lot of trial and error also, but then there's also the idea of creating experiences. I think I'm more interested in this in the times when the food tastes really good but looks like shit. Where either because you've created this visual experience where everyone's just like pawing away at it with their hands and everything's starting to crumble and fall apart and it just becomes this like detritus on the table, but everything still tastes good. I aim more for those experiences than something that looks beautiful and tastes like fondant. I hate fondant.
Right.
I think it tastes disgusting, but you can see all these beautiful fairy tale cakes made of fondant and then you eat it and it's so disappointing. I hate that.
But while I totally agree, I think there's something really intriguing about your oat flour, cocoa powder adaptogen thing, because it's kind of like, even though it wasn't the most delicious thing, it's at least kind of hopeful or maybe optimistic in that these items can be combined and give the eater this desired experience. And I feel like that's still successful in some way.
My problem was I tried to grind my own oat flour, so the texture wasn't that great, and then I wasn't really looking at the recipe properly, and I added too much salt, but that's okay.
Okay, so for another time.
That's just my, I'm bad at following recipes. I'm more just like, okay, I'll throw this stuff in together. That's why I like fermentation, because it's often just a gut reaction, and you're basically just in with your elbows deep, just figuring it out. You know, yeah, you can put too much salt, but then you just add more vegetable and you wait longer. Baking is really a whole different ballgame for me. I haven't gotten there yet. It's a little too rigorous.
I feel like that's a really unique take on fermentation, though. I feel like a lot of people, myself included, are really intimidated by fermentation.
Because
it's like there's this active live thing that's happening without your control.
That's what I like about it.
Yeah, but then how would
it's
you...
It's so fascinating.
Are there things that you like, visual cues that you look for?
I mean, often it's just taste. If things are bubbling, that's good. That's a good sign. If it's not getting black, that's also a good sign.
Not moldy.
No mold. Although if there's like white yeast, that's okay. You can scrape that off. The calm yeast is fine. Some cultures actually mix it back in for flavor. It might be a little too intense. That's also a preference for people. So I'm making tepache at Clavel now, which is a Oaxacan restaurant in Baltimore. They have a mezcal bar. And they do this fermented pineapple drink called tepache. And so it's pretty much just pineapples with their skins mashed, fermented in their own juices. And then we add spices and some piloncillo sugar and let it ferment a couple more days. And then press it and bottle it. We've recently been experimenting with bottle conditioning, so it has a more active mouthfeel, which is exciting. That, like, every batch is different because the weather is different, the pineapples we get are different, and it's all just about like smell, taste, and like feel. And that for me is my favorite way of working with food, because it changes constantly and I just have to go with my gut. in a way that makes sense for the product at the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to follow a recipe because it's always changing slightly. And it's more interesting for me that way. I'm a little ADD, and so I need there to be like a lot of change and activity where I get bored. Yeah.
Okay, so if I were to do this at home, can I do it small scale? Like if I just chopped up a pineapple, put it in like a deli container?
Yeah. 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 It's, I'm making like 15 gallons at a time now. So I'm thinking about it small scale, but you could just take one or two pineapples and you want to slice them into small triangle pieces with the skins on, and then you want to mash them.
Some Why people, triangle pieces?
Well, just so it's an easy mashable piece.
Got it.
I'm just thinking visually, like that's what I do. I cut it in half and then a quarter and then I chop down the line. Mm-hmm. So it's a little triangle and it's cute that way.
Yeah.
But tops off. The tops can make it a little bitter. So you can use the top to kind of hold everything down in its juice. And people do it differently. Some people just add water and kind of like mash it a little bit. Some people really mash it and have it ferment in its own juice. It really depends on like the flavor you want. If you have it fermenting in more water than juice initially, it has more of like a sour beer.
Ooh.
It's a little bit lighter, not as dank. The dankness is something that we at Clavel really enjoy. And then you can add, some people add like a jalapeno pepper at one point just to give it a kick. Yeah. Or some sliced ginger. There's a lot of different ways to do it. We just add some hard spices. Yeah. So star anise and cinnamon. Not to totally divulge our secret recipe, but that's the thing is like with ferments, it's hard to have a secret recipe because no matter what, it's always going to change a little bit.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. We can have a component that we might not share, but in the end of the day, no matter what I tell you, it's going to turn out differently for you. Just with what you have, the bacteria in the air in your apartment versus at the bar lab, like it's all different, And the vessel. So you can use plastic, food grade plastic. You can use glass. Just be careful that you don't like bust through the glass while you're mashing it. People use wooden barrels. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It all creates like a different experience for the pineapple. You get different flavors. Yeah.
So what are you doing at Bar Clavel? What is besides?
So I came on in December. A good friend of mine kind of helped set up the bar. She's opening up a cafe and larder called The Larder in Baltimore, hopefully this summer or the fall. And she actually came in from the Bay Area as also a food artist. Her name is Helena, and she worked at Hex, but after I did. We actually didn't meet until later. All these people were like, oh, you have to meet Helena. I have to meet Rosemary. And I've had the opportunity to help her with some of her great pop-up brunches. And she makes some beautiful food. Helped Lane Harlan, who owns Clavel, set up like a lab space for basically doing more of the ingredients for our cocktails at Clavel in-house. So we make our own tajin, which is the spicy salt on our margaritas. We make a basil oil using a miniature centrifuge called a spinzol.
Oh, God.
It's really great, except for when you have to clean it. That's a pain. And then all the tapache. Mm-hmm. And depending on the season, there's different ingredients coming out of the bar lab. So right now we have a umeboshi plum honey for one cocktail. Gosh. It's really good.
Did you make the umeboshi yourself?
So, no, but I want to. I was actually looking at recipes.
Yeah, you can umeboshi anything.
I know.
So,
maybe that should be our next project.
Yeah, no, our Cookquest, guy. Yeah, he's coming on in a few weeks.
Oh,
and
that's great.
He's posting all these things where it's like, oh yeah, I just umeboshied a green apple and a plum and all these other things and like threw some coffee in it. And it's like, oh, so
smart.
See,
there's so much I still have to learn. That's the thing that's so great. It's never ending. Yeah. I still have to put a fish in my nuka pot.
Don't stick it in. You got to just remove some of the bran and just coat it.
Ah, okay, okay. So we have kind of upped our production of tapache now that we have the space, which is exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the lab has been a way to kind of see. The nice thing is I also have started bartending in the bar downstairs. And so I get to see the whole process, like creating. And I've changed some of the recipes based on actually working with the drinks too. Mm-hmm. So And our spring cocktail list came out a month or so ago, and it's been really fun to, because I came on in the winter in a point where the cocktails were already set and I was just making all the products, mm-hmm. the ingredients, and now I was able to be part of that experience of brainstorming with all the bartenders, figuring out what drinks worked, and mm-hmm. then working through all the ingredients to have them ready and make sure we don't run out during the week. So, mm-hmm.
do drinks follow trends in the same way that foods often do?
I honestly don't drink cocktails that often, mm-hmm. even though I make all these things for cocktails. I will say we have some good cocktails right now, but if I'm going to drink booze, I like drinking a little bit of mezcal straight, mm-hmm. Or just with like lime and seltzer. Mm-hmm. But I think people are starting to, Baltimore is a little bit behind in the times, but craft cocktails, I feel like have fallen down like on the wayside for more fun, juicy tiki cocktails. And then I don't know. I think a lot of people are also just getting more excited about wine because there's wines that are more lively and young. Mm-hmm. But we do have a really good wine list right now. And Lane is in the process of opening a wine bar.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And with sake, actually, and then natural wines. Mm-hmm. So that's something that she's working towards right now, which is exciting. But yeah, for me, I think I want to drink things that taste like kombucha but are a little alcoholic. So like a sour beer or like a really effervescent wine, mm-hmm. or like, yeah, soda, lime juice, and mezcal. That's pretty simple that way. Mm-hmm. If it's too heavy or syrupy, it just gives me a headache. So, but it is, the interesting thing is while I don't often drink that many cocktails, I love making them. I love all the movements. I think that kind of connects to my experience of doing the Nuka and finding this dance with it. Mm-hmm. It's definitely so performative. And I'm not one of those like shaker people that's like all over the place.
I love when they do the orange twist, yeah, and just like, let it settle.
We have some fancy men out there, and women and people. But I just also, the movements though are really fun, and I feel that activity in a way that I also loved about working on a line cooking, mm-hmm. although just in a different, it's more performative because often people are watching you. Although mm-hmm. an open kitchen would be the same.
Yeah, totally.
But when I worked in an open kitchen, it was brunch and I was wildly stressed out and like throwing eggs.
Don't look at me.
I guess I have a little bit of anger management. It comes out of brunch.
No, yeah. I think that's totally a thing. It's performative in that if you don't have the muscle memory down either, you're going to drown.
Yeah. And that's the people that do the best, I think, in that field are the ones that can get into that meditative state and they have that muscle memory and nothing gets to them. Because once you start going down, you're like, you can't get back.
Yeah.
And I see that often in both fields, like mm-hmm. bartending and in the kitchen. It's like something ticks you off and then you're just like deep diving down into this anguish and you're so mad. Hard to come back.
Before Bar Clavel, did you have other food jobs? Or
yeah,
how do those different, how does working as the bar lab like manager, the one who's kind of designing all these ideas, how does that kind of converse with your history and maybe doing like front of house or something else?
Well, I've worked in a lot of restaurants over the years. It's always something to fall back on, but also because I love food and the intensity and the activity around it. And when I got back from Nordic Food Lab, I really wanted to have more cooking experience. So I started off front of house at an oyster cellar and then was working cold side, which was great. I learned a lot. The chefs I was working with had been working in the industry for a long time at various restaurants in Baltimore and New York. And at the same time, I helped a girl in Baltimore open, well, I didn't help her open, but I was one of the first people to work at this breakfast brunch spot called New America. So I was kind of doubling sometimes working breakfast and going and working at night.
Oh, man.
And I was exhausted and not making any money, but that's the thing about cooking. Mm-hmm. But I learned a lot. The thing about working at New America was that I wasn't working under any more experienced cooks. And so I was trying to like put systems into place that I didn't know about. Right. I just was like making it up as I went. So that was kind of interesting, stressful, but learning a lot more at night, but then trying to figure out ways to implement it in this larger space, in this whole different scenario and environment. Mm-hmm. Then I kind of got run down and I took a break and walked dogs for the summer.
And made more money.
Yeah, I made more money. And then did a residency in Dublin this past fall. And I was at a place called The Fumbly, which is a cafe, and they have this adjoining stables where they do workshops. A lot of fermentation projects come out of there. And I actually got connected through a friend who I'd met in a residency in Berlin. The last couple of years, I've been traveling a lot and doing a lot of residencies and different food-based projects, which has been wonderful. Now I'm kind of trying to put down roots back home. Yeah.
So besides the tapache, what are you working on now, or what are some projects that you have lined up?
We're trying to really like streamline the tapache for Clavel and just see where that takes us. Streamline in the sense of just get more consistency, maybe not always flavor-wise, because that's going to kind of change with the season. Mm-hmm. And then I think trying to just like find balance with my work. I've been working so much this winter. After traveling, I was like, I'm going to pay off my student loans. Finally. So I've been kind of hustling really hard and feeling a little worn out in the sense that I haven't been able to even think about the future. Just like work every day, sometimes have a Monday off. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of ready to take a little step back and reassess and see. I think for personal projects, doing more pickling at home just with my boyfriend and kind of experimenting with dishes there. And I think building a little bit more of a food styling portfolio, just because it's a great way to make a living. And it's also something I really enjoy, that I've always been taking photographs. And I think it's a good balance between a lot of my interests, and there's a good market for it. Mm-hmm. And I think people are open to more experimental aesthetics when it comes to food styling these days. It doesn't have to be your, like, plate with a bun and some lettuce spritzed with glycerin. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. No, I feel like a lot of that stuff is already seen as old hat and doesn't really register on our radars
anymore. I mean, now people like the girls from Lazy Mom are getting actual jobs doing... I mean, they did the intro to Ugly Delicious for one of their... episodes, which is great. I love their work. And so it's exciting to see people that come from a different background getting more jobs using that more experimental vibe for editorial work and stuff like that. Yeah. So that's cool. I'm just trying to survive. Yeah. Survive and thrive with my microbes.
That's a perfect way to end. I've been speaking with Rosemary Liss on Meant to be Eaten. This is Heritage Radio Network. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please... join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.